Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to honor the legacy of the late Monty Irvin, who passed away January 11th at the age of 96, a Hall of Fame baseball player who might have had an even more legendary career if World War II hadn't interrupted all of that. In this interview, recorded in 2010, we've already heard about how he grew up as the 11th of 13 children in a very athletic family, and how as a college football player, he moonlighted as a pro baseball player in the Negro Leagues. He even had to use a pseudonym and only play in the road games because if he tried to play in the home games in New Jersey, they'd figure out he was Monty Irvin, not some guy named Jimmy Nelson. You sure couldn't get away with that today. Pretty incredible. And if you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you know I try to ask every veteran about one specific date that changed the world. We've heard some pretty unique answers, but I don't think we've ever heard one quite like Monty's.
Everyone seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Standing on second base in Puerto Rico.
Really?
When they announced that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. And the people started to cheer. So I said to myself, I said, they don't know, you know, what a big problem that's going to be. Because everything that came into Puerto Rico came in on a ship.
Mm.
You know, the rice and the beans and everything else. And then 3 weeks, everything, rice and beans tripled. The price of rice and beans tripled down there. And so I definitely will remember, you know, being on second base when I heard that this disastrous thing has occurred.
Yeah, not many people can claim that they were standing on second base at the time.
Yeah.
And then Uncle Sam would get his hands on you. What did it mean to you when you were drafted and you realized that you're going to have to put baseball on hold and go serve?
I did. I had just left Mexico, you know, the MVP down there, won the, you know.
The Triple Crown, right?
Well, no, I won the home runs and the batting average.
All right.
They had 25 home runs, and my batting average was .397. A fellow by the name of Silvio Garcia, a wonderful Cuban player, beat me out by 2 runs for the Triple Crown. But he had started playing down there a month before I got there. So I felt pretty good about it. But I knew that, you know, you had to go. I had a daughter who was only 6 months old. I didn't want to leave her and my wife. But, you know, Uncle Sam called, saying we had to go. I was drafted, spent my training in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and after about 6 weeks, went on down to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a few months, we caught the a troop ship going to England. It was in the North Atlantic. For 19 days, and the North Atlantic can be rough, even in the summertime, but in the wintertime, it's almost impossible. And so in 19 days, we were on that ship in a convoy of 500 ships, and guess what? We didn't lose one ship out of a convoy of 500. But when we got to Liverpool, we couldn't stand up because of that rocking and roll. Yeah, that was a funny thing.
That would do it to you. And much like baseball was segregated at the time, the military was segregated at this time. And
yeah,
so you
that
were
was
in
tragic.
The 13th Engineer General Service Regiment?
Yes,
With all African-American soldiers?
Yeah, at the beginning, we had a white officer, and later on, he was replaced by an African-American CO, and then we got two or three other lieutenants. You know, we felt, you know, more comfortable, and was treated a little better. So during in 1944, after they invaded, June 6, 1944, was D-Day, but we didn't get there until 2 months later. And when we got there, Omaha Beach had been cleaned up. After staying around the beach for a while, we moved across Paris and settled on the other side. And then mainly our duty then became guard duty. A lot of the Nazi soldiers had surrendered, and there was a problem because there were so many of them. We had it was a chore trying to keep track of all of them. So that's what we mainly did until the war was over in Japan.
Now, I did read that your unit, during the Battle of the Bulge, that your unit was assigned not necessarily on the front line, but in reserve and near Reims, France.
That's true.
In the Meuse line and ready to blow up bridges if the order came?
Yeah. We blow up bridges and doing a lot of guard duty of refineries, because we knew that the Nazis wanted needed fuel. Our whole outfit was guarding the fuel depots, and luckily they stopped them, up at the Battle of the Bulge, and they never did get to Reims. But Reims was only about 60, 70 miles away, and if they had broken through, there was going to be some heavy fighting in and around Reims, France. We were so happy that it didn't happen.
Now, I've read before, and I've interviewed several African-American veterans from World War II who told me about how they were treated overseas and then how they were treated back in the States. Did you notice a difference, and did that time overseas give you a new perspective?
Yes, it did. We were treated better by the natives, by the English and the French, and then people from Belgium. We had a lot of problems with our own soldiers, mainly, and why they wanted to, be so anti, we just couldn't understand it. And then after we came back here, back to the States, we were scorned also, and we couldn't understand why. We were called on to do a job, and we did it. But seemingly, nobody appreciated enough, to welcome us back home.
Now, while you were overseas, and you mentioned how hard it was to leave your daughter behind, your wife
mm-hmm.
behind.
Yeah.
Was there something that kept you motivated overseas, that kind of kept you focused on what you had to do day in, day out, believing that you would get back?
Yeah, well, we knew, that we had a duty, and we knew that if called on to do combat, we'd do that too, you understand? But mainly, obey the rules and, try to do what you're supposed to get back home safely. And luckily, most of our guys did come back safe and sound. But if we had been called on to do battle, we were ready to do that.
Do you still remember what it felt like to come back home to see your wife, your daughter again?
Yeah, it was after almost 2 years, it was wonderful to come back home. My daughter, she's about, she's about 3 years old. She didn't know her father. We had to get her acquainted and so on. But that was a happy chore because I spent most of my time, with her and my wife, to make up for lost time. That was the beauty part of coming home.
Well, I'm sure on cold nights in France, in a foxhole, you probably weren't thinking, I'm going to be a baseball Hall of Famer someday.
No, not at all. In fact, before I went over, I never thought that we'd ever get the chance to, play in the majors.
Mm-hmm.
But after going, seeing how things were done over there and so on, some of the guys was very happy that they experienced a lot of freedom. And when we came back, the saying was, if they can fight for the country, why can't we play for them? So there was a move afoot, to get us into major leagues. I remember Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia had a group, and he was, along with Adam Clayton Powell and some other politicians, had that in their minds to do it. But then Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, so that's
Hold on there, because the way I heard it, Branch Rickey wanted to sign you.
He did, and uh-huh. I signed with him. I told him I'd had a hard time, didn't have a chance to play at all over there, and I said, I'll sign with you, but I'll let you know when I'm ready. He said, well, that's great.
And you had some ringing in your ears from all the artillery overseas?
Yeah, I had inner ear problem. And 2 years, got better. And then I, started to play like I had been playing. So all worked out fine.
Are you glad that it was Jackie Robinson who bore the brunt of some of that?
Well, let me just say this. When Jackie was signed, a lot of us were not envious, or not jealous, but we were envious. because talk about Buck Leonard, Josh, and Josh Gibson, and Willie Wells, and Ray Danger, some of our real stars, mm-hmm. Cool Papa Bell. If they had started just a little sooner, they were, I call them the old masters, and they were, you know, the best at their position. I just wish they could have seen Satchel when he was in his prime and so on, you know, right on down the line. So, in selecting Jackie, they picked a college-educated person who had gained publicity and notoriety out there at the UCLA. He starred in four sports. He was wasn't the best player, but he was the most adequate person that Branch Rickey could have taken. And then, lo and behold, Jackie improved every year. He became a clutch hitter. He became a real good second baseman. He became very thrilling on the bases. So it shows you that, how, I guess, smart that Branch Rickey was by picking Jackie. And we're all grateful and very happy that he did such a great job of pioneering.
Oh, and it sounds like one of the reasons you said wait on me is you felt if you were the first one and you weren't 100% that you wouldn't have represented your whole league and whole class and race
true.
Of people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it worked out just the way it should have.
Worked out just fine. Jackie did a great job. You know, he passed away in 1972. Can't believe that he's been gone that long. But he did one super job. Had to take a lot, but he did. And we're, again, very grateful for the wonderful job that he did.
And his legacy certainly lives on. And you had some moments that were reminiscent of some of Jackie Robinson's greatest base-stealing feats. I want to ask you about that, but let's take a quick break, and we'll come back.
Yep, it was break time then, and it's break time now. But our tribute to Monty Irvin will continue after this with his memories of two of the most famous moments in Giants history. And knowing what we know now, with San Francisco winning it all 3 times in 5 seasons, it'll be interesting to hear what Monty Irvin had to say just before they launched that dynastic stretch. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV Country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV Country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.